Hello and welcome to Heart Centered Change. In this episode, I, Lynette Hunter, and my colleague Jeanette Mundy talk about words making the world. This is a brief introduction to six language actions which are really useful if you're looking to make or manage change in your life. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, Lynette. Welcome back to Heart Centered Change.
Thank you, Jeanette. Very happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, today we're actually talking about speaking actions. So what are speaking actions, you might ask? Well, what we would like to share with you is that when we use words, either silently or verbally, we actually bring into existence a particular reality for ourselves.
That's a big idea.
It is a big idea. Mm.
And it's probably not the way that we've traditionally looked at language, but it's been a lot of research and a lot of linguistic research, but also in other areas, philosophy and so on. And I suppose one way of defining it is to look at some of the work that Alan Seiler has done. And he's been our teacher in the ontological course. And he says that language is now regarded as a process. So in other words, not such a fixed thing of just little marks on a page or sounds, but a process. And it's a form of doing. It's a form of doing by which we make the world happen for us. Mm-hmm. So another one way of looking at it is to say that the language that you live in determines what is actual and possible in our worlds. So I'm going to say that again because I think it's a lot to take in. The language you live in determines what is actual and possible in our worlds. Mm. And that's a bit of a change, thinking of it as a more creative, active process than just a fixed description of what reality already is that you can't change. And because we're very interested in change, you and I, particularly heart-centered change, this is absolutely at the centre of what we want to help people with when they're looking to make an alteration. Something isn't working for them. What can they do? They can use language, because language is an action.
Mm. Beautiful, beautiful. So think of it as your change process for a minute. So we know that something is about to change, either by that it's really obvious to us that change is about to come, or that we all of a sudden wake up and make a decision one day, this has to change, something needs to change about this. So many people want to make a change in life, but they just find it really, really difficult. They tend to go around and round in circles. We've done that ourselves. We'll have you know.
many, many times
we've done that ourselves. And so what we want to do is to bring this heart-centered approach to change where you can create a process that actually works for you and not against you.
Yes, and what that makes me think about, Jeanette, too, is I suppose when I first started coaching, I was trained as a life coach, which isn't a term I use about myself anymore. But at the time, I was very into goal setting and time management and helping people with all the different domains of their life, making lists, setting goals and all the rest of it. And it was successful. It's not that goal setting doesn't work. In fact, it's something I use all the time in my own life. But it didn't change what the outcome was. It was focusing on a different aspect of self. It was focusing on the behaviour at the end of the process, not the way of being that gave rise to the behaviour in the first place. So it was a little bit further down the track. If you think about you here deciding that, in my recent example, I'm going to lose weight. So here's my decision that I'm going to lose weight, and here's my goals and my sets of behaviours. Now, a coach could come in and help me with all those goals, but if I don't actually believe that I'm worthy, that if I, in my way of being, don't see my body as something to nurture and care for, if I don't love myself, in the long run, that isn't going to happen. Those behaviours, I might lose weight short term and then put it back on again in the long term, things will not necessarily change for me. The change needs to happen right there in that way of being, in that dynamic interplay we talked about in episode one, in the language, in the feelings, and in the body, all three together.
Mm-hmm.
Writing about it, thinking about it isn't enough. Feeling it isn't enough. Doing the exercise isn't enough. All three together need to work as one to make change. So that's where the coach intervenes, into the way of being, intervenes, perturbs. That's the word I want. I'm getting a little bit carried away here, Jeanette. Stop me if I'm going too far, but I do feel very passionately about this because I've seen the limitations of that kind of coaching, which would be like a first order learning, I suppose we'd call it.
Mm. So in your way of being, Lynette, would you mind if I ask you a question?
Not
about
at all,
that?
Go ahead.
In your way of being, what did you see as a pattern that was keeping you in that process of not creating that change that you wanted? What words were coming up for you?
That's a great question, and it's a really huge answer, because it didn't come up until I was in a very deep coaching conversation, a very light, fun-filled coaching conversation, but I saw that I didn't trust my body. That I had a conversation with it which said, you betray me. You take me where I don't want to go. You make me do things I don't want to do through your desires and your horrible... It was like I was talking to another person. It was like my body was over there, had nothing to do with me, and it kept on betraying me and taking me places that the rest of me didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And until I forgave myself for those choices, I really couldn't begin to care what happened to my body. And the very next thing that happened, Jeanette, almost 6 months after that, was that I was diagnosed with cervical cancer. And I don't want to go into any kind of connection thing about it, but if I hadn't had that forgiveness and that understanding of my body, I think my reaction to that diagnosis and that news would have been extremely different. So it gave me a world of possibility of moving forward with looking after myself.
So if you betrayed me, you're letting me down, that sort of language, if that was the action that held you where you were, what was the action that flicked a switch that finally said...
So the language action
that
changed it was, I forgive...
I forgive.
I forgive myself for, and I began to listen to the conversation and trust that my body knew and was telling me messages and knew.
Did trust have a language?
No, it had more of a feeling of curiosity. It's something I'm still working on. I was never taught to listen to my body. I didn't know how to do it, and I'm still learning how to do that. So I don't always I don't always get it right. Not get it right, but I don't always hear it fully. But yes, the language of it is I don't know. It's more a feeling of curiosity.
More feeling.
Yeah,
that's curiosity.
Going on? Yeah, the question. Okay, yeah, so it's questions. What's going on?
Questions.
What are you telling me? What's happening here?
Yeah.
Sitting in it, learning to... Going to yoga has been a hugely helpful thing. Sorry, have we got off the track here?
I don't think we've got off. In my assessment, we haven't got off the track. In my assessment, this is a really nice demonstration of how language and words are just not on their own in isolation. You related it to a feeling. And it was curiosity of what's going on. But feelings, so that's what Lynette's referring to there, is curiosity is actually a mood. So would it be okay if I go one step further with that?
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah. So if that mood was experienced in the body, what did it feel like? What did it look like? What shape did it have?
It was a much lighter feeling, a much more open one, almost a dance move. You know, spreading the arms, doing a little, not that I'm a ballet dancer, but, you know, a little glissé across the room, a little lift. a very light on the toes type of feeling.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And that light on the toes type of feeling, that, you know, lifting the arms like a dance move type of feeling, that is a physical action. But the words that go with that and the emotion that goes with that is an action that orientates you towards a different future. That's what happens in language and in the words that we use. So this is what Alan Seiler is referring to. Language is regarded as a process, a form of doing by which we make the world happen for us. Yeah.
So I don't know whether people listening can hear certain aspects of those feelings in my voice as I talk, but I think it would be likely because it comes through in the voice as well.
Yeah.
That's an aspect of the body by which we can really gauge where people are at with something and how they're feeling, how deep it's held in, how much breath there is, and so on. Mm-hmm. So probably you'll be able to hear the emotions, a range of them, going through me as I talk about this aspect of life, because it certainly was life-changing, and it came after many, many years of grappling with weight and health and looking after self and damaging self and so on and so forth. So something I'm still a lifelong learning in that area, I'm sure. Not that I've got that learning done, I haven't, but the change is enormous.
Wow, that's beautiful, Lynette. Thank you. Thanks for sharing. Oh, thank you so much for sharing. These are the vulnerable spaces that we go to sometimes in our life's journey and in our heart-centered change. We step into these vulnerable places quite often. And to be able to step into that place and feel safe.
Well, I was about to say I do feel safe with you because we've worked together in this way in many times, and I know that you will always ask for permission and you will always take care of me when I go into those vulnerable places. So that's
and vice versa, by the way.
Yes. Well, your turn may come.
Yeah, I'm sure it will.
So back beautiful. To the script. Where were we?
All right. So look, so far we've read and we've explored the realities that we create through the words that we use, and we've related that back to our way of being, which is encompasses language, which is words and listening, our emotions and our body, how we embody it. Now, the next thing we'd like to share with you is what we call linguistic acts. These are actual actions in language that we use every day that sometimes we're quite unaware that we're using and can be used really ineffectively and sometimes really effectively. So what we'd like to explore with you is we'd like to outline each one of those six linguistic acts and give you examples of those, which we think will be enough for this particular podcast because they're quite big concepts.
That's right. And then we're going to go on in the future and spend a bit more time with each one and really tease them out and give you some really useful. And the way these are particularly helpful, I mean, once again, it's a model. It's not the truth. It's something that's been very useful for us because having the distinctions about what's actually going on in a conversation and what kind of speech act I'm using at any particular time or linguistic act has made a big difference to how I'm able to be careful with the words that I use and hopefully that leads to clarity, not just for other people but also for myself about what I'm intending to do, how I'm going to act in the future, or how we might coordinate that action. So in essence, these actions, if I might just list them, Jeanette, and then we'll go into them separately. So there are assertions, assessments, declarations,
requests,
thank you, offers, and promises. And we're going to go in and give you a little mini definition of each one and perhaps an example of how they work and how they might not work for you. So starting off with that that very interesting one, assertions, which lots of people know as fact. So assertions deal with deciding what is and what is not factual in the world. That might sound odd, but we'll explain that in a minute. So this isn't a trivial thing because we base much of our reality and daily living on what we know to be factual. But some things change. Some things are a fact one day and not the next, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm. Yep, scientific facts.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. Yes.
The scientific community. They come up with facts based on the studies that they've done, and that's fabulous because that helps us to progress through science, into medicine and all sorts of wonderful things that the world now benefits strongly from. However, those scientific facts can change when some other scientist comes up with something else that either adds to that or disputes it. And proves that it's not a fact.
That's right. So in the 19th century, for example, there was a thing called ether. Everyone believed that there was this invisible stuff in the universe called ether, and it surrounded the world and was part of everything. And so everyone wrote about it, acted as if it was a scientific discovery, acted as if it was in poems. When you read writing, you'll hear mention of it. The word ethereal comes from it. And then one day it was discovered there wasn't any ether, so there was no more ether. So it existed, and then it didn't exist. It was a fact, and then it wasn't a fact. So we think of facts as being very concrete, but not always. Not always.
No. Well, the world's round.
Mm.
It's no longer flat. We know it to be round.
That's right.
But once upon a time, it was only known to be flat.
Mm. And in fact, in human knowledge, it was round at the very beginning, the discovery. Then it went to flat, and then it came back to round again. So, yes, we can think of lots and lots of examples of how we change the facts around it. So just to know that they're not, and we often, yeah, well, we'll get into that, how we can confuse facts with opinions later on.
Well, can I give an example of an assertion? All right, so something that I was treating as a fact was I'm stupid. So I'll go back to episode one. I was giving you that anecdote of my life and my father telling me that I was stupid. Well, the story was from then on in, I'm stupid.
It was a fact for
you.
It
was a fact for
me. You were living it as a fact.
I was living it as a fact.
Mm.
So every action that I took, so remember, okay, words are action. So every action that I took in life was based around I'm stupid, and it probably translated to things like I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy of this, I couldn't do that because. Those are the types of stories that I ran based on that underlying assertion, I'm stupid. So I think what's important here, what I'd like to make the distinction of is that we might have this underlying assertion that we don't even identify that we've got it. It sits so deep in the background.
Well, yeah.
So it might sit underneath everything else. It might not necessarily. It could come up, but sometimes it sits underneath everything else. And then the story that we create around that, I couldn't possibly go and run my own business. I couldn't possibly use technology. I'm not good enough for that. I have no idea on how to use it. What can be sitting behind that is that very statement that we've created, that I'm stupid or I'm something else.
But yes. Yeah. Well, it isn't actually a fact, though, is it? Because it's really an opinion, which you're living as a fact.
But we're living, yes. I was living it as a fact.
Believing it to be true.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so sometimes these assertions work. We need an agreement on, how long something is, so we all agree on the length of a ruler that's divided into inches or centimetres, and we all agree what that's going to be, because we have to have some way of measuring and counting and sharing with each other what's going on in the world. But there are a lot less of them than we like to think. I know one of the exercises we had to do was write down a situation in our coaching training, Jeanette. Do you remember that? We had to write down a whole situation, a paragraph or something of everything that happened in a situation that was really annoying us, an issue. And then we had to go through and find all the facts in it. Well, I tell you, I did not do much highlighting. It was only about, in a whole page of writing, there was only about two facts.
me too. And actually, every training I've taken after that, every one I've facilitated, many people in the room share the same experience. Yes. Well, I couldn't find facts in that.
Mm. Mm.
So they're not assertions.
No. They're one of the next language action that we're getting onto, which is assessments or opinions, which is the judgments and opinions that we make about things. And this can be something quite small, like that wall is painted white. Now, you may turn around in a minute, Jeanette, and look and go, no, it isn't, it's oyster grey.
Mm. Well, I was about to say that.
Were you? No, I'm putting words
actually, it's not white, it's a bit more grey, a little bit more grey. It's not cream,
That's right.
It's an opinion.
It is an opinion. even though something we might be able to say, oh, well, it's a fact that the wall is painted white, that's still our perception.
Mm.
And we need to question just how many times we state things that we think are facts when they're not.
So I wonder if at this point, to help our listeners really understand the difference between assertions and assessments, we could do a little exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Could we do a little exercise?
I'm always up for a little exercise.
Okay, fabulous.
A little experiment?
Yeah, all right. So while you're sitting there in your room or standing there or going for your walk, or whatever you're doing while you're listening to this podcast, pick something and pick something. Pick the tree, if it's a tree that you can see. Just something in your vision. Piece of furniture. The floor, the carpet beneath you, or whatever it happens to be, pick something and make a statement about it. Make a statement about that thing. We'll do it in this room that we're in at the moment. So, okay. So Lynette and I have got the air conditioning on in the room at the moment. The air is really cold in here.
Is that a fact? I don't think so. That's your experience of it. I don't find it really cold.
Are you comfortable?
I'm comfortable.
Are you comfortable?
Yes.
I'm not comfortable. I'm cold.
Right.
Okay.
Well, so we're experiencing and perceiving different temperatures.
Very different temperatures, yeah. Now, it could be the fact, it could be the position that we're sitting in the room or just how our bodies operate. Yeah.
So you could make a declaration, I feel cool.
Yes.
And that would be true.
Mm. Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
Are we going on to the next?
Doesn't seem to be. I've leapt ahead. But I'm just thinking to myself, it's really important to make these distinctions about what kind of language act we're because it so often confuses a conversation when we overlap them and mix them up together.
Something I learned years ago, an analogy, a little example of what I learned when I was doing some marketing many, many years ago, was not to put too many things that people could perceive different things on the marketing material. So, for instance, the woman that was taking the photos, she was just a beautiful marketer, and she had beautiful photography, and she would just say, "No, don't write about how many birds sing in the trees outside, because not everybody likes the sound of birds singing in the trees outside. They're going to come up with their own thoughts around that." And they might make the judgment that this is not a great place to live because there's so many birds singing. Oh, I don't want to wake up to the birds in the trees in the morning. Bugger that, I'm not even going to go and have a look at that house.
Gosh, yeah. So is that why real estate writing is so bland?
That's why it's so bland. You've got to stick to the facts. It has four rooms. It has two bathrooms, blah, blah, you know.
Mm. Yes. Yes, well, they're very interesting.
So people make assessments because they're judging what feels right for them.
Mm. And we need to. We need to make assessments. Mm. And we need to judge whether we can trust someone. We need to judge whether how fast the car is travelling so we don't, step onto the road at the wrong moment or drive in the wrong direction. These are all necessary judgments that we need to make to exist. But we really need to be aware of when we're making them and they don't serve us, especially in regard to our own selves, about what we're able to do and what we're not able to do.
Mm.
Mm.
So for a heart-centered person who's changing, it's crucial that we tune in to what are the judgments and opinions that we're holding about ourselves or about a situation or about what we can and can't do or what we are or we are not, that are creating our reality for us.
Mm, it might be holding us back from a possibility.
Yeah, that we're treating as assertions.
Yes, exactly.
True assertions.
Mm. So we're going to spend a whole episode on that because that is a huge, huge area, the whole assessment area. And we've given you quite a few examples of that already, so you can tell how often it comes up in our conversation, just how important it is. So the next one we were talking about was declarations. And the next language action of declarations are statements that have an authority behind them, and they bring about a change in circumstances. They're talking about how the future is going to be from now on. So I could say, I now declare peace across the world, but I don't actually have the authority to make that happen, so that declaration doesn't have any weight. But I could make a declaration, I'm going to catch a plane on Friday, or I'm going to only eat fruit on Thursdays, and I can make that happen. That was a silly one, but you get the idea.
Well, it's only silly if you think it's silly.
Oh, that was an assessment.
That might be an assessment.
I made an assessment. It was silly. Everyone else may not share that. No. Oh, you see how confusing our conversations can be when we jump from one to the other.
Yeah, yeah.
So have you got an example of declaration, Jeanette?
Yeah, well, the declaration that I make that I am stupid, that's a declaration. That's actually stating the future.
Is it?
Is it?
Mm. Well, it is an assessment that... I think the one that you were saying before, like, I can't do that because I am stupid, or I will not enroll in that course and because I'm, you know, because I have this assessment about myself. That's very much a declaration, isn't it?
Mm.
I will never be able to do such and such.
Such and such, yeah. So declarations change the future.
They do.
So can we, this is interesting, I think, find this very interesting because sometimes we can make declarations about the future that we want and yet it doesn't really hold any weight with us because we don't really necessarily believe what we're stating.
Yeah, we didn't give ourselves permission.
Didn't give ourselves permission.
Or give ourselves the fear or recognise our own authority in the matter.
So we might make a declaration along the lines of, I'm going to exercise 3 times a week. But unless you give yourself the authority to do what you want to do, it's not going to not necessarily happen.
Mm. Yes. Yes, we have to be very careful how we use declarations because we can end up letting ourselves down because they actually are connected to promises then that we're making to ourselves about the action that we're taking to make the declaration. To bring it into fruition. So, a more simple example, because we're getting into quite some heavy territory here, might be that you decide you're going to wash your car yourself and not take it to the car wash.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm going to wash my car, not take it to the car wash. That's a declaration. I may decide to go to a movie on my own. There's another declaration. I might decide to sleep in 10 minutes longer on a Saturday morning. So there's some very simple declarations about what I'm going to do in the future.
I think do you want to expand on declarations a little bit or not really? Do you want to move on?
No, I think we'll move on for the moment. Okay. Looking at the all time, right. Because we've got three more actually which are all connected to each other. Requests, and this comes up a lot in coaching because we often ask our coaches, what are some requests that you're not making? And we can be reluctant to make requests, but without requests, things don't happen. Mm. We need to be asking things of other people to coordinate action with them.
Mm. Or to coordinate action with ourselves.
Yes,
yeah. Both. Both.
So, but they're not foregone conclusions. They're a question, and there are different answers to them. So we'll go into that when we discuss requests in greater detail. But the definition I have here is they are attempts to have people do things for us.
I think that's actually really beautiful.
Mm.
So often requests are not made very effectively, and so it doesn't matter how much we attempt to get somebody to do something, have someone do something for us, they might not necessarily do it.
That's right. And the saying is, if you make a what is it? If you make a starts with S, you get a slippery promise. If you make a sloppy request, you get a slippery promise, right? Thank you.
Yes.
Finally got there. Yeah, so we'd like to help you when we get onto that. Make an effective request.
Yeah, we'll get absolutely. An absolute we'll get answer. To that. Yeah. We'll get to that. So.
Mm. But I know that they're an integral, but if you start think about how often you ask people to do things in either in an email or when you ring them up or when you're trying to organise an event, you'll realise that the coordination of action absolutely depends on making lots and lots of requests and making them as clear as possible.
And for someone who wants to make a heart-centred change, making requests is crucial because we we rarely do things in isolation with others.
That's right. So, we need our network of help very often to support us in whatever we're doing.
Absolutely. Right.
Okay, and so then we get onto offers. So
offers.
Yep.
Hi, Lynette. Would you like me to wash your clothes for you?
Oh, thank you very much, Jeanette.
Okay.
Go
no
right,
problems.
Go for it.
All right. Okay.
I'll take you up on that one. So offers are when we put ourselves forward to do things for others. We notice that there's something missing for them. So it might be offering them a lift to go somewhere,
mm-hmm.
or washing their clothes, very sweet of you, making them dinner, or whatever it might be, putting an offer forward. Because you see, the other day I was walking to the station and a couple of friends turned up in their four-wheel drive and offered to take me and my suitcase to the station. I was very grateful for that.
It's so good. Yeah, it's a lovely offer.
It was a lovely offer.
And maybe they had to go out of their way to take you there
as well.
They had to go out of their way, but they were okay to do that.
They were okay to do that.
Yeah. We make offers all the time, don't we? We make offers every day.
Yeah.
Often, though, it's an important facet of being able to make change is to consider what sort of offers that we're making.
And if we're making too many.
And if we're making too many.
And getting overwhelmed by everyone
the
taking
process.
Them up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that can be the balance between making requests and making offers. Is really important in that. It can be out of whack. That's right. So one of the answers to a request is to say yes. And when you say yes, you made a commitment. You've committed to doing something else for others, and that's a promise.
That's a promise. Yeah.
And promises to oneself are also, I think you mentioned earlier, also very important because there's a huge amount of disappointment in saying you're going to do something, making that promise to yourself, and then not doing it is a letdown. And when you realise that that promise is a commitment that you need to be held to, or you can be held to account with, it makes a difference to how you hear that being said.
Yeah. Look, you know, if we're constantly making commitments to ourselves and to other people, and the change process is going to require certain commitments to yourself or to other people. It's going to require that. So it's not trivial. Making a promise to yourself, which results in a commitment, is definitely not trivial. Sometimes we make promises that we don't feel like we can live up to. And what's going on, what we can think of then is what's going on in our way of being where I don't feel like I can ever live up to that promise. The thing that's holding me in that pattern of not getting to where I want to go in life. What's going on? What promises have I made to myself that I'm not fulfilling for myself? And it's a beautiful question to ask non-judgmentally.
Easier said than done.
Easier said than done.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lovely exploration of what all this entails and how it can be so integral to anything that we want to move along in our lives.
I've got one more point, and that is the language of obligation versus the language of possibility. Just to tie this all in.
I where I was going.
You were going with that, were you?
Go right ahead.
Okay,
so the
language of obligation is when we use the words we should, we must, we ought. I must, I haven't done that and I should have. I should have done that. Why didn't I do that? That is the language of what we call the language of obligation. But not only that, it really has this sort of feeling behind it, this judgment sitting behind it, that perhaps we're not everything that we feel like we should be. We're not living really up to our own expectations when we use the language of obligation.
Oh, and other people's expectations,
and other
isn't
people's
it, really?
Expectations,
because
yes.
In this role that I've got, I should be a better housekeeper, I should be a better mother, a much quieter... I should turn my phone off when I'm doing a podcast. that's the sound of me throttling Jeanette, just ignore that. So, be me next time. It's interesting that language of obligation, it's a burden because it's a duty, and there's a whole lot of judgments, so many judgments come into it. Whereas the language of possibility that you were about to mention is much more open. And I've fallen into this trap of using one kind of language when I meant another by saying, because I'm very much an ideas person. When I started my business, I'd be telling people, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to make a podcast, I'm going to, you know, make a video, I'm going to run a course, and then I wouldn't get up to it, something, or I'd forget about it, because really in my head it was just an idea. But I was using the language of declaration, of saying I am going to do it. People heard that as a promise. And then when I didn't fulfill it, they were disappointed in me, and they judged me to be unreliable.
Mm.
And they'd say things like, oh, she's all talk. But that talk was an action.
Mm.
And that talk was painting me as an unreliable. And that's not a good thing to be in business, to be unreliable.
Mm.
So now I'm much more careful. I use the language of possibility. I say, I might make a podcast. I could write a book. I am thinking about the possibility of. And then...
And I wonder what that might be like. Start exploring those possibilities.
Yes.
Which is a beautiful space to then make clear declarations from. If you come back to declarations, it's because the declaration is a lot more solid, a commitment than I might. Wow, I wonder what that would feel like. I wonder what that looks like. A declaration is actually stating the future. But when you can open up that space of possibility, it actually opens you up in your body in that way. Instead of closing you down, which the language of obligation tends to, it's got this very heavy feeling about it in the body, and there's quite a difference. So it might be interesting for our listeners to explore that. Just have a think about what happens as they move through their day, and they all of a sudden the language of obligation crops up to them. What do they experience in their body when that happens? And then perhaps experiment with a change. Oh, what if I tried this? And using that language of possibility, open up a little bit more of a curious way of looking at things. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion and a lovely opening up to experimenting in a playful way, and starting to notice, which is something we harp on about, starting to notice and observe what's going on with you in your own way of being around these different language actions. Even if you could start to notice or question, which one am I using now? Because that is really in itself, learning this has made a huge difference to my life and how I converse with people and with myself and how I enact change in my life. So I really would, and I also think there's a little handout we have on this, Jeanette, am I right?
Yes, we have a handout on it, and I'm wondering at this point, I'm sitting here and I've got a curiosity about how our listeners are actually perceiving this particular podcast, because it is such a heavy topic.
It's a big
topic with lots of details sitting behind it. So what might be really helpful for you and for us is if you do make some comments about how this all sat with you, give us some comments and let us know what you're thinking about it, because what we can do is that if there's something that was really unclear to you, or it didn't make sense, or you wanted a little bit more on that particular linguistic act, that actually helps us to help you in the future.
Great point. So you can leave your comments underneath the podcast in the discussion area, or you can get in touch with me at lynette@wildsky.coach or on my website www.wildsky.coach, or Jeanette at your site.
Yes, www.jeanettemundy.com.
Lovely.
Yep. Okay, wonderful.
So please keep those cards and letters. Keep those cards and letters coming in. A little spooner is in there. And we look forward to talking with you and our next podcast, where we're going to start exploring a few more of these linguistic acts in more detail.
Beautiful.
So goodbye from me.
Bye.